From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
It was a busy day for President Trump on Thursday. Earlier in the day, he held a press conference at the White House, laying out the latest in the effort to control the pandemic coronavirus. That follows his signing into law Wednesday a relief package that aims to provide free testing, secure 2 weeks of paid emergency leave, and increase federal funds for Medicaid and food security programs, among other things. Later on Thursday, he held a press conference at FEMA headquarters in Washington, D.C.
Everybody ready? Okay, Jed, do you want to start it? Do you want to start off?
Well, Mr. President, Vice President, thank you for being here. Really appreciate your visit to FEMA. I think your visit really, as you indicated last week, by signing the national emergency, has really empowered FEMA. We've gone to a level one here at the NRCC and continue to support the emergency, continue to support all elements, and really working with the interagency and our state and local partners. The governors, who you'll talk to here in a few minutes, know the FEMA process, know how that works in cases of both natural and man-made emergencies, and that's the process that we'll be using going forward, making sure that they are linked up with their emergency operations centers and tied into FEMA. So again, thank you for being here. We look forward to your remarks. So thank you.
Well, thank you very much. And it's great having FEMA involved. We've had tremendous success working together, and we appreciate all of the people here. And it's an honor to be with all of you. You're doing a fantastic job, by the way. And so now we're, as of yesterday, when we gave the order, FEMA is totally involved in addition to everybody else. And a lot of progress is being made. So I look forward to speaking to the governors. And from what I understand, we have pretty close to 50 of the governors and some territories on, and we have a lot of just about everybody showed up. So that's very nice. And we will put them on the screen as soon as you want. Thank you. Thank you very much. Mike, you want to say something?
Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you, Mr. President. And I want to add our thanks. Not only to the great team here at the National Response Coordination Center and FEMA, as FEMA takes the lead in implementing the policies that you approve from the White House Coronavirus Task Force. But as you do continually, Mr. President, I want to thank all the governors that are joining us today. Today is an opportunity to talk about the progress that we are making on mitigation. On testing, on supplies, we understand as FEMA's mission that this effort through FEMA will be locally executed, state managed, and federally supported. And I want all the governors to know that we are with you every step of the way. We are absolutely determined at the president's direction to make sure that you have the resources and the support. As you see, to the health and well-being of your communities, we commend the governors. At this point, Mr. President, as we told the country today, three states are 50% of the coronavirus cases in America today. So we're focusing resources at the point of the need. The governors in those states, their state health officials, are responding with great professionalism and great speed. We'll continue to support those that are directly impacted. But by standing up through your national emergency declaration, Mr. President, standing up FEMA and standing up the National Response Coordination Center, we want our governors, we want all of our state and local health officials to know that we are, as you say, bringing the full weight of the federal government to bear to support our states and our local communities, and that we'll get through this coronavirus and we'll get through this together.
I agree with that 100%. Thank you very much.
Meanwhile, Thursday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres addressed journalists and the public in a live virtual briefing where he laid out three critical areas of action in tackling the coronavirus.
Ladies and gentlemen of the media, it is a pleasure to be with you in this virtual stakeout. I know one of the UN correspondents has been hit by the epidemic. My thoughts are with all of you. in this difficult moment we are all facing. We are facing a global health crisis, unlike any in 75-year history of the United Nations, one that is spreading human suffering, infecting the global economy, and upending people's lives. A global recession, perhaps of record dimensions, is a near certainty. The International Labour Organization has just reported that workers around the world could lose as much as $3.4 trillion in income by the end of this year. This is, above all, a human crisis that calls for solidarity. Our human family is stressed and the social fabric is being torn. People are suffering, sick, and scared. And current responses at the country level will not address the global scale and complexity of the crisis. This is a moment that demands coordinated, decisive, and innovative policy action from the world's leading economies. We must recognize that the poorest and most vulnerable, especially women, will be the hardest hit. I welcome the decision by G20 leaders to convene an emergency summit next week to respond to the epic challenges posed by the COVID-19 pandemic, and I look forward to taking part. My central message is clear. We are in an unprecedented situation, and the normal rules no longer apply. We cannot resort to the usual tools in such unusual times. The creativity of the response must match the unique nature of the crisis, and the magnitude of the response must match its scale. Our world faces a common enemy. We are at war with a virus. COVID-19 is killing people, as well as attacking the real economy at its core, trade, supply chains, businesses, jobs. Entire countries and cities are in lockdown, borders are closing, companies are struggling to stay in business, and families are simply struggling to stay afloat. But in managing this crisis, we also have a unique opportunity. Done right, we can steer the recovery towards a more sustainable and inclusive path. But poorly coordinated policies risk locking in or even worsening already unsustainable inequalities, reversing hard-won development gains and poverty reduction. I call on world leaders to come together and offer an urgent and coordinated response to this global crisis. I see three critical areas for action. First, tackling the health emergency. Many countries have exceeded the capacity to care for even mild cases in dedicated health facilities, with many unable to respond to the enormous needs of the elderly. Even in the wealthiest countries, we see health systems buckling under pressure. Health spending must be scaled up right away to meet urgent needs and the surge in demand, expanding testing, bolstering facilities, supporting healthcare workers, and ensuring adequate supplies with full respect for human rights and without stigma. It has been proven that the virus can be contained. It must be contained. If we let the virus spread like wildfire, especially in the most vulnerable regions of the world, it would kill millions of people. As we need to immediately move away from a situation where each country is undertaking its own health strategies to one that ensures in full transparency a coordinated global response, including helping countries that are less prepared to tackle the crisis. Governments must give the strongest support to the multilateral effort to fight the virus led by the World Health Organization, whose appeals must be fully met. The health catastrophe makes clear that we are only as strong as the weakest health system. Global solidarity is not only a moral imperative, it is in everyone's interests. Second, we must focus on the social impact and the economic response and recovery. Unlike the 2008 financial crisis, injecting capital in the financial sector alone is not the answer. This is not a banking crisis. And indeed, banks must be part of the solution. And it is not an ordinary shock in supply and demand. It is a shock to society as a whole. The liquidity of the financial system must be guaranteed, and banks must use their resilience to support their customers. But let's not forget, this is essentially a human crisis. Most fundamentally, we need to focus on people, low-wage workers, small and medium enterprises, the most vulnerable. And that means wage support, insurance, social protection, preventing bankruptcies and job loss. And that also means designing fiscal and monetary responses to ensure that the burden does not fall on those who can least afford it. The recovery must not come on the backs of the poorest, and we cannot create a legion of new poor. We need to get resources directly in the hands of people. A number of countries are taking up social protection initiatives, such as cash transfers and universal income. We need to take it to the next level to ensure support reaches those entirely dependent on the informal economy and countries less able to respond. Remittances are a lifeline in the developing world, especially now. Countries have already committed to reduce remittance fees to 3%, much below the current average levels. The crisis requires us to go further, getting as close to zero as possible. In addition, G20 leaders have taken steps to protect their own citizens and economies by waiving interest payments. We must apply the same logic to the most vulnerable countries in our global village and alleviate their debt burden. Across the board, we need a commitment to ensure adequate financial facilities to support countries in difficulties. The IMF, the World Bank, and other international financial institutions play a key role. The private sector is essential in seeking creating investment opportunities and protecting jobs. And we must refrain from the temptation of resorting to protectionism. This is the time to dismantle trade barriers and re-establish supply chains. Looking at the broader picture, disruptions to society are having a profound impact. We must address the effects of this crisis on women. The world's women are disproportionately carrying the burden at home and in the wider economy. Children are also paying a heavy price. More than 800 million children are out of school. Right now, many of whom rely on school to provide their only meal. We must ensure that all children have access to food and equal access to learning, bridging the digital divide and reducing the costs of connectivity. As people's lives are disrupted, isolated, and upturned, we must prevent this pandemic from turning into a crisis of mental health, and young people will be most at risk. The world needs to keep going with core support to programs for the most vulnerable, including through UN-coordinated humanitarian and refugee response plans. Humanitarian needs must not be sacrificed. Third and finally, we have a responsibility to recover better. The 2008 financial crisis demonstrated clearly that countries with robust social protection systems suffered the least and recovered most quickly from its impact. We must ensure that lessons are learned and that this crisis provides a watershed moment for health emergency preparedness and for investment in critical 21st century public services and the effective delivery of global public goods. We have a framework for action, the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development, and the Paris Agreement on Climate Change. We must keep our promises for people and planet. The United Nations and our global network of country offices will support all governments to ensure that the global economy and the people we serve emerge stronger from this crisis. That is the logic of the Decade of Action to deliver the Sustainable Development Goals. More than ever before, we need solidarity, hope, and the political will to see this crisis through together. Thank you.
Secretary General, we're now going to take questions from the press. This is a virtual press conference, the first of its kind for you in our age. Our first question is from Edith Lederer from the Associated Press. She asks, Mr. Secretary General, you're calling especially on the G20 countries to take the lead, but many of them are struggling to deal with the COVID-19 pandemic in their own countries. Where is the money going to come from to fulfill the ambitious program you just outlined?
Well, we see that whenever there is a problem in the banking system, trillions appear to solve the problems of the banks. And these trillions must appear now. Governments, central banks must work to guarantee that there is liquidity in the economy, but also that funds are mobilized to those that are most in need. And those that are most in need are people, on one hand, and the poorest countries, on the other. And it is absolutely essential to show solidarity in the way we respond to the crisis. A wealthy country must not be convinced that it has only to deal with its own citizens. It's in the interest of a wealthy country to contribute to a global response, because the crisis can come from wherever, at any moment, and it is in the interest of everybody to fight it effectively, especially in the most vulnerable areas of the world.
The next question is from many journalists collectively. Are you concerned that the restrictions on travel will boost nationalist sentiments? You say that international cooperation is the answer. How do you achieve that?
I think that the restrictions on travel can be understood because of the need to contain the spread of the disease. But it's very important that at the same time people feel the need of solidarity. It's very important to fight fake news, to fight those campaigns in social media that try to spread fear, that try to spread antagonism, that try to create divisions. This is a moment of solidarity, and this is a moment where political leaders, religious leaders, community leaders must convey a very strong message asking for people to feel that we need to do this together. And even if we are physically separated, I am physically separated from my family at the present moment, but we are together fighting this crisis. And I think that the same must happen with countries, the same might happen with peoples. We can be physically separated, but we need to do it together.
The next question is from Valeria Robecco from the Italian news agency ANSA. Africa is now experiencing a limited number of cases, but some experts fear that there will be a wave of cases in the near future. Are you working on some plans to help the most vulnerable areas?
Yes, our teams in Africa are working very hard with the governments to support them. But my very strong appeal to the G20 is to have a particular concern with African countries and other countries in the developing world. We must absolutely be strong in supporting them, because the virus will come, is coming to them, and their health systems are extremely weak. So they need a very strong support from the developed world. And if that support is denied, we could have catastrophic consequences. If the virus is not contained because countries have not the capacity to contain it, it can spread like wildfire, as I mentioned, and we could have, even with low rates of mortality, we could have millions of people dying, and this is absolutely unacceptable.
We're going to take two more questions. This next question is from a number of journalists. As you know, the journalists gathered here are working in this building, and they want to know, is it worth the risk to keep the UN Secretariat building open, and can the UN Security Council and the General Assembly meet virtually?
First of all, we were ahead of the curve in the UN, and the UN headquarters. We took precautions earlier than they were prescribed, even by the authorities here and in different other parts of the world. We have been extremely careful in order to contain the spread of the disease. I'm working in headquarters. Most of our staff is working at home. And I believe that when people absolutely need to come, they can come, because I think we have created the conditions to do it in perfect safety. On the other hand, it is very important to create the conditions for member states to be able to meet. The Security Council will meet next week more than once. And we have provided conditions for virtual meetings to take place at any moment. In some circumstances, physical presence is needed. In others, it is not. But we have all the conditions to allow for virtual meetings to take place with any number of people. I was just today in a virtual meeting with our 140 resident coordinators around the world. I've been in contact every day with 8 to 10 of our offices around the world and of our missions around the world. And I can tell you I'm very proud, because even in these very difficult circumstances, the UN everywhere is open for businesses, and we are working to make sure that we deliver in relation to the member states that need our support and in relation to the people we care for, the most vulnerable everywhere.
Final question from Majid at Ruda Network. Does the SG think there should be any special financial support from developed countries to the developing countries, especially the ones dealing with other crises such as wars?
It is absolutely essential to have solidarity at the present moment. It's absolutely essential that the effort that the developed countries are making to support their own citizens is extended to those countries that have not the capacity to do the same to their citizens, and where poverty is much more widespread and the conditions to fight the disease are much less effective.
Also on Thursday, Maria Zakharova, the spokesperson for Russia's foreign ministry, laid out what Russia is doing about the coronavirus crisis.
I would like to once again reiterate something we had already mentioned the other day. In order to coordinate work inside the ministry and in order to cooperate with the relevant federal authorities when it comes to assisting Russian citizens abroad that wish to return to the Russian Federation in the context of the spread of the coronavirus infection, the Russian MFA created a coordination headquarters headed by Vice Foreign Minister Alex Siromolotov. It includes representatives of territorial and functional structures of the ministry. Constant contact is maintained with the members of the headquarters. The leading department is the Crisis Management Center, which carries the main burden of coordinating the work between our embassies, structures, and in order to maintain contact with our citizens. The department operates a 24/7 multi-channel hotline. Phone numbers have been indicated in the statement published by the Russian MFA on March 17th. Operative officials on duty receive and process requests from Russian citizens that are abroad in a difficult situation due to the measures undertaken by foreign states in order to contain the spread of the coronavirus. In almost 48 hours, of the center's work on high alert, it received via hotlines over 6,280 calls, over 5,000 messages and messages through WhatsApp. Due to the ever-growing number of phone calls, we intend to expand our communications capabilities to that end on the MFA's website and on the website of the Crisis Management Department. A relevant link will be published in the text of the today's briefing statement. It will include a section dedicated to those who want to return to their homeland from abroad. It will feature a special electronic form in order to identify the citizen and collect their contact data. There will also be emergency phones of our foreign missions. The Russian MFA, in the framework of the coordination headquarters, together with foreign missions, applies efforts in order to repatriate Russians from different states if they so wish. List of those who wish to return to Russia are being compiled and processed at the moment. The Crisis Management Center of the Russian MFA has contact data from 5,500 Russian citizens. Diplomats on the ground cooperate with the authorities of the countries in order to obtain permissions for flights and in order to solve the ensuing matters. Sometimes they provide assistance to accommodate people. When possible, they transport them to airports when it is possible. They also provide other kinds of assistance. At the same time, we understand that we have to do more. Because everyone finds themselves in a very difficult situation. Work is underway in order to transport back Russian citizens from other countries. As of today, Aeroflot flights S7 and other companies' flights managed to transport a few hundred people from Montenegro, Uzbekistan, Latvia, Slovenia. We are working on bringing Russians back from the Philippines, Chile, Morocco, Latin America, the Canarian Islands, which are rather difficult destination to bring Russian citizens from. Aeroflot continues to operate regular flights to the capitals of 17 states and transports our citizens to Russia. I would also like to mention that European countries upping their restrictions, including the closure of outside borders, bans against moving through national borders in the Schengen zone, and limitations for movement inside certain states, as well as cancellation of flights and closure of land borders, led to a situation when, in a number of states, people, Russian citizens, found themselves essentially hostages. Sometimes we can explain it by forceful measures caused by the severity of the situation. Sometimes it is not the measures themselves that affect logistics, but rather political components or bad organization of the local authorities. It is important to note that due to these restrictions and quarantines, many tourist destinations are in a kind of a limbo, which are popular among our citizens. A great number of Russians cannot return to Russia. Some of them are thrown out of hotels. This is the result of quarantine measures. Multiple visa complications arise. The Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, foreign missions, do everything in their power in order to resolve those problems. I can assure you that we are working 24/7. But I would like to reiterate once again that we are going to do everything possible in order to make up with our efforts for the problems aligned with the issues which have yet to be solved. I would like to once again draw your attention to the fact that all contact numbers are published on the Russian MFA website. It is very important for those who are abroad and want to return to Russia to constantly be in contact with Russian diplomatic missions. It is important in order to receive information regarding their readiness of flights that they could avail themselves to. I would also like to state that diplomats make efforts in order to cooperate with the countries of stay, with their governments, in order to receive the necessary data and help collect the necessary information in order to repatriate Russian citizens, as well as to receive permission for flights out of the countries. We would also like to draw your attention to the statement made on the 14th of March this year. The President of Government of Russia, Mr. Mishustin, recommended that Russian citizens either postpone or cancel any kinds of foreign trips. This recommendation is very relevant at the moment. Every hour we register new demands and new criteria of quarantine as well as cancellations of flights or suspension of those flights in a number of states. As a matter of fact, in the majority of states of the world.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.